Thank you very much for this introduction. It is indeed a great honor that you have asked us to be present here, and you have asked me to give this lecture, given that the role of the Comrade was so prominent in the activities of not only the Turkish left in London, but also, I think, of the Middle Eastern left, from what I can gather from other Iranian comrades. I will try and answer a lot more of the points that I raise in this talk in the sessions that will follow, in responding to the questions and to the debates that I will hear. However, I am going to talk principally on why political Islam is a threat to the left in the Middle East, and how its relations with capital and class and its role in terms of dividing society in many ways poses many threats to all of us as activists of the left. I'm afraid I'm not going to go into any answers to this issue, but I think that even by raising some thesis on the kind of dangers we face, maybe it will help us as political activists, as communists of the region, to try and find jointly, both in the written format and in the spoken format, answers to such issues, because I certainly don't have any ready-made answers, if you like. As Comrade Balik said quite correctly, we are facing in many countries the prospect of the popularity, at least, of political Islam. And this popularity has a lot to do with its claims, at least, that political Islam seeks justice, social justice, economic justice, and many of its propaganda is indeed aimed at the poorest sections of the society, hence the challenge to the left. And in many ways, the experience of Iran as the first country where political Islam has been in power for 26 years and 10 months already, and where in its neighborhood, in Iraq, we are seeing the establishment of another Islamic Shia republic, there are a lot to be learned from what has happened in Iran, both in terms of what will happen, in my opinion, and is already happening in Iraq, thanks to an occupation that has cost so many lives and so much money, but also in terms of the kind of government of Sharia law that non-Shia Muslims profess to support. Now, I do realize that the talk I'm giving is based on a Sharia law under Shia, and therefore there are differences. However, many of the issues I raise do go beyond the Sunni-Shia divide. Some don't, and I will try and point the differences. The first point that one can make about Iran's Islamic Republic is that the government that came to power in order to bring a level of social justice, at least to the Iranian people, has ended up with some of the richest sections of the population becoming much richer, sections of the upper middle classes becoming super rich in Iran, and the poor getting poorer. So we can at least see that the first claim of political Islam in terms of bringing ending corruption and bringing a level of social justice has not worked. But what is important is the kind of political relations that have facilitated this furthering of the division between the rich and the poor. What are the basis? What are the, if you like, the policies, the ideas, and the thoughts that ferment this level of political division, of class division? I would like to start by stressing that in our opinion, as the two people who wrote the article in Critique called Political Islam, Its Relation to Capital and Class, we see this as a modern phenomenon. We do not accept this idea that it's somehow just a return to the past, that it's simply, if you like, a retrograde Islamic movement that has an ideal of going back to the era of Muhammad and so on. It certainly, in our opinion, has arisen from the new social order in the Middle East. Even in Iran in the 70s, when it was growing as an opposition movement, it was a reaction to the form of capitalism and imperialist domination that existed at the time during the Shah's rule. And it, in its current format, I would say that one should still see it as something that unites or aims to unite those sections of the society, of modern Islamic society, that are being left behind by the kind of uneven capitalist development we see in the countries of the periphery. That's true, I think, of Egypt as much as it is of Iran. It's true as much of Indonesia as it is of many other countries. And for that, I will concentrate on the four main layers of society that form the basis of the political Islamic movement. Inevitably, a very large section of the population that is influenced by it are the urban uprooted. People of peasant origin who have been forced to migrate to major cities like Cairo, like Tehran, like Istanbul, primarily because of impoverishment of the rural areas. And they are the inhabitants, if you like, of the shanty towns of these areas. Inevitably, many of them do not have jobs in or they do not have permanent jobs. They have temporary jobs, seasonal jobs, construction jobs, but more often they're involved in what is called sections of the black economy, peddlers, stallholders, that category, and therefore live a very uneven, unsecure economic future in the way their income is based. And the second layer, which has obviously played an important role in many aspects of the financial backing of political Islam, is the middle layer belonging to pre-capitalist structures, mainly the people of the bazaar, the shopkeepers, the people who are close to the mosque have a certain level of income, and yet in the modern capitalist state they are not taken seriously either as earners of a level of fortune, but also more importantly they are not taken seriously as in the political sphere. They have no voice in the modern pro-capitalist or pro-Western states that exist, such as Egypt, such as I would say maybe even Turkey. I don't know, but I would imagine Turkey. And it's partly there the kind of industry they are involved in, which makes them this marginal side of, if you like, economy, such as small workshop owners, people who are in the whose only outlet is the bazaar or merchant sections of small towns, and as a result do not become involved in the bigger picture of the economy, the dollar economy of the main capitalist state, which is involved in international dealings. The third layer are those sections of the industrial sector or even reasonably rich people. For example, during the Shah's time, some of these people were, some of the supporters of the political Islamic movement were not necessarily, if you like, underprivileged capitalists. They were reasonably well off. But they're excluded from centers of power for various reasons. Either they are not part of the clique that is in power. In Iran, they weren't part of the court and the Shah system. They're not part of the modern state. In Egypt, they're not part of Mubarak's inner circle. Or wherever you look, there is that level of alienation from the state, from the state that dominates that particular country, and therefore they cannot be involved in decision making at the level of either the national or the international level, and they feel separated from it. And fourth, of course, our students, intellectuals, those sections of society that are the children, or if you like, the second generation of the two former groups I mentioned earlier, who do feel resentment towards a level of injustice that they see internationally, and yet, because of developments I will explain later, including the whole policy of the West during the Cold War or various other issues, are certainly anti-left, anti-communist. But they do, for example, feel solidarity with the injustices of Palestine or injustice in the world in general. Of course, because of their limited view of what this could imply, they're much more concerned with injustices to the Islamic community as opposed to the world community. Very rarely do you see them sympathizing about poverty in Latin America or deprivation in Africa. They're far more concerned with injustices in the Islamic society. So that differentiates them, if you like, from the leftist youth in many of these countries. And that's a fourth category. With this support, I think one has to say that the political Islamic movement has a number of characteristics. And in this section, I'm going to briefly mention some of these characteristics. Although it is a modern phenomenon, but it's definitely anti-enlightenment. And this idea that at times is portrayed, I think, in the British media, that if only Islam has enlightenment, then everything will be resolved. I don't know if you've heard it, but many people come and say, you know, the problem with Islam is it hasn't had enlightenment. Well, as a modern phenomenon, as a reaction to the way capitalism has developed in the world, it's a bit of a miracle if this Islamic movement suddenly saw enlightenment as a way forward. In a way, it's a reaction itself. So how could it? Enlightenment comes through a process of development, of evolution, and so on. If it's a reaction to another phenomena, it obviously cannot automatically find enlightenment. This doesn't mean that there hasn't been enlightenment or elements of enlightenment within Islam. But political Islam, as the kind of phenomena we are facing today, either in the form that is taking, I don't know, military action, or in the form that is taking towards establishment of Sharia law governments in various states, is by no means seeking enlightenment or going towards it. It's going towards a Sharia law, which is quite specific. So the fact that it's modern, it doesn't mean that it has modern solutions to the world's problems, if you can accept this contradiction in my talk. And in a way, as part of this kind of almost singular monolithic obstructionism, it tries to bring together under one umbrella the uproot poor and the super rich. The rich, or at least the rich, maybe not the super rich, but at least the rich. And it treats as enemies anybody who questions Islam's fundamental rules and laws. It's actually quite strict on that. It has many terms, both in power and in opposition, about those Islamists who question scientifically or in other ways the way Islam's history has developed. They are called people who believe in sharing God. They're non-monolithic, tashrik. They believe in and these are all derogatory terms used for those who are not part of this monolithic Islamic movement. But I think as far as the left is concerned, the main issue and the one that is the most striking is that it's vehemently against any form of class lineup. Anything that has to do with class allegiance is an enemy of this political Islamic movement. It has to deny class antagonism because otherwise it cannot have a single umbrella of political Islam. If you are trying to unite the Bavarian merchant who is quite well off, I mean he might not be as rich as the car manufacturer's plant owner or somebody like that, but he's certainly quite well off, with the poor guy who lived in a shanty town in Cairo or in Tehran or in Istanbul, you have to say the one thing that unites us is Islam. Let's not break this unity with class. Because once you talk of class, you can't have these people in a single movement. And it does that to the perfection, in my opinion. And that's where its main danger, its main, if you like, threat to the left is in this phenomena of trying to deny class antagonism. Those who do talk of any form of, if you like, class identity or class lineups, or who at least think that there is talk to be done with communists and socialists within the country, I don't mean with the anti-war movement, within the countries that they live, are actually repelled and sent away from the political Islamic movement. In Iran, this was done quite dramatically in the early 1980s. I will go into the details if once we are into the question and answer session, but it really has a completely uncompromising attitude towards those sections. Of course, as you know, on the one hand, it has some kind of nationalism. There is elements of nationalism in the political Islamic movement. But on the other hand, it really does not recognize national boundaries and its other characteristics. Because it wants to create this united Sunni or Shia, or they can't have both in the same category. I think that's one of the luck of the left and the communist movement, that we can't have them in one state, the two of them. But because of that, it does go beyond boundaries of one country. And it does say that it's the Ummah, or the masses of Muslims who will unite under this Sunni republic or whatever it is, this Sunni Islamic state. And that certainly was true of the Shia state in Iran. And in fact, that is what the Americans, whether aware of it or unaware of it, unintentionally, in my opinion, have created in Iraq a Shia state. It also, by definition, has to be against the form of, and here I don't want to be too Eurocentric on this, but in terms of all the things that we consider as Middle Eastern people signs of democracy, i.e. The fact that there should be no difference between every individual in terms of their civilian citizens' rights and political rights. Because by definition, at least in Shia Islam, and here there is a difference between what the Sunni political Islamists want and the Shia Islamists want, but in Shia Islam, the hierarchy in the clergy creates a set of rules by which some people are nohbegan, or the elite, if you like. They're the grand ayatollahs, then they're the ayatollahs, then they're the lower ayatollahs, and so on. And they are the people who have the direct line to divine forces and so on. They hear the messages, so to speak. And the ordinary people are just ordinary people. And so there cannot be a democracy or an equal right for these individuals and those selected few. Now, I do understand that Sunni religion defies this because there isn't that level of hierarchy in the structure of the clerics in the Sunni religion that exists in Shia Islam. But in Shia Islam, as you know, an ayatollah becomes a center of guidance, like Sistani is to the Shia population of Iraq, or is one of the centers of guidance, or Khomeini was to many Iranians and many Iraqis. And as such, you follow everything this person says. It's not that it's only at election time that he produces a list. He actually produces a list from about everything you can do from the moment you wake up to the moment you sleep. The only time he's not controlling you is when you are asleep. I mean, if you look at, I don't know if any of you have looked at Ayatollah Sistani's website, but he actually has rules about drinking water, putting your pen down, you know, everything you can imagine he's got a rule about. And in such a system, you cannot have equality of individuals, equality of citizens, or the fact that these citizens would have equal rights in terms of elections, participation in voting systems, being elected, and so on. So you have the structures of elections, but all of these structures are dominated by a much more powerful entity, the Grand Ayatollah, the representative of God, or as it is called in Iran, the guardian of the imbecile. Because he actually, the rest of the population are the people who are not, who haven't got the mental capability to make day-to-day decisions, and he is Ayatollah Khamenei, and he makes those decisions. So in these definitions, these ideas of elections and citizen rights and so on go out of the window. Now, if you look at the Sunni clergy, there are differences, but all I would say is that even in the Sunni hierarchy, if you listen to some of the talks by, for example, the followers of Al-Qaeda or Muslim Brotherhood, they do say that there is this, that Sharia has explained all this, and there is no need for this level of elections and representation. There is one time and one time only where the Islamic movement accepts elections or referendums, and that is for coming to power. That happened in Iran in March of 1979 when they asked the nation to say, do you want an Islamic Republic or do you want the Shah back? And the question is obviously, you know, the referendum question already makes clear what you would answer. And the same is true of the Iraqi regime. There was a referendum. Do you want the current, you know, occupation plus Shia government? And although many people didn't vote, but the Shia population had a duty to vote. So if you like, the participation of ordinary people in the electoral process, in the decision-making process, is singular, is once, and that's once alone. A number of factors have allowed the political Islamic movement to develop, and I think we have to be realistic to those factors if we are to see how it acts first in opposition and then in power. And I'll very briefly try and go through some of these, it's almost like titles of what are the issues that make political Islam a power. And one of them is that if you look at the way the last 30, 40 years have worked out in the Middle East, although in terms of political power, the state has enormous power, because in many of these countries it's either a dictatorship or a semi-dictatorial regime. In terms of economic power, of course, globalization has taken away a lot of ordinary economic decision-making out of the hands of these states. So the state has a contradictory nature in that on the one hand it has some power, but on the other hand it has lost power on some issues. And in this, there is certainly all the demands of the IMF the World Bank, the loans that these countries are involved in, make their decision making much more limited than it was in the 1930s or the 1940s. And this in itself creates a crisis of the level of political hegemony that existed or needs to exist in order to keep a coherent rule, power against ordinary people. On the other hand, the bourgeoisie in all of these states has gone through a very sudden development. It hasn't grown through the whole process of, if you like, the normal process of feudalism and bourgeois development, the classical way. very often a landowner has suddenly, as a result of reform from above, maybe the Charles Land reform, maybe the Green Revolution here or there, has suddenly been given a lot of money. With that, he has invested in factories. And so one day he was a feudal, next day he's a capitalist owning a big factory. He hasn't gone through, there is no process through which this whole development has taken place. And this does affect the way in which the structures in these countries work. If you like, there isn't the kind of long-term development of capitalist structures that allows the state to control every aspect of people's economy and political life. And that in itself brings with it a lack of any form of liberalism or acceptance of different ideas, monolithic ideas. It isn't that, as some sections of the media like us to believe, that somehow the people in the Middle East can't understand democracy or don't know it. It's the way capitalism has developed in these countries that makes it much more difficult for the kinds of organs or organizations, political structures that allows pluralist liberal thought to develop. That hasn't existed in many of these countries. And of course, the weaknesses of the left, which I don't want to go into in this talk, but the weaknesses of the left in terms of what it did in the 1950s or the 1960s or the 1970s, the mistakes of, if you like, its attitude towards the Soviet Union, it's almost worship or total acceptance of everything that was happening in the Eastern Bloc disappeared with the collapse of the Eastern Bloc and hasn't been replaced by anything new for various reasons, not all of which are the fault of the left. But more important than the two elements that I mentioned, there are other facilitating elements within these states that allow the political Islamic movements to grow. At the height of secularism, so to speak, in Iran during the Shah's time, and I'm sure it's true of Turkey, at least in present day, I don't know about the more secular period, the Islamic groups had the kind of legal and political immunity that no other political force of the opposition had. I mean, if you were even if you were a moderate leftist in Iran, you would be arrested, questioned during the Shah's time. And yet, if you were an Islamist of any kind, you weren't the favorite people of the Shah. You weren't liked by the Shah, but your existence was never questioned. You were never arrested. You were never in the kind of you were never facing the kind of repression that socialists and communists faced during the Shah's time. And that's true of many of these countries, especially during the Cold War. There was a policy by the U.S. and various Western governments to actually encourage Islamic movements such as Hamas, such as the Muslim Brotherhood, in order to defeat the communists. And that was both financial in terms of the way the state tolerated these groups and all sorts of other ways. So in many ways, the ruling political administration's tolerance of religion was far more than what it showed towards the left. And in terms of the international politics, that was the case as well. Both in terms of Afghanistan, the way, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood was used against Nasser, the way Ayatollah Kashani and later Ayatollah Kashani was supported in 1953 against Mossadegh and so on. So throughout the last 50 years, really, you can see an international policy that allowed such developments. And one last but not insignificant element in the growth of the political Islamic movement was, of course, the Islamic government in Iran, the coming to power of the first Islamic state, not only because of the if you like, the illusion is created amongst all of these Islamists that you can gain power. And really there, it's a long debate, but there were many elements that came together. Not only the fact that the Shah had tolerated the growth and development of politics within the mosques, within the schools of religion and so on, and had at the same time completely decimated anybody who was a socialist or a communist or even a liberal was part of this. But also the illusions created by the defeat of the Afghan government. And here the Sunni political Islamic groups, especially the supporters of bin Laden, have a double illusion. They think that they single-handedly got rid of the Soviet Union, of the Afghan government, but they also single-handedly defeated the Soviet Union. Both of which are wrong. If it wasn't for the CIA, neither of these would have happened, neither the first nor the second, or without the USA. And so these illusions that you can gain power has changed, if you like, the nature of the political Islamic movement. They now really see themselves potentially capable of achieving this power. And, of course, the existence of Islamic states, such as Iran, allows the development of other Islamic states. If you look at the two main military political powers currently in Iraq, Skiri, the militia of al-Ja'fari, the prime minister, and Dawa, the other military political section, these were financed, armed, trained in Tehran in the 1980s and in the 1990s. In fact, one of the reasons many Iraqis resent them is because they're a foreign phenomenon. They call them Iranians, apparently. In some parts of Baghdad, people call the Skiri armies that is the main bloc that supports militarily al-Ja'fari, the prime minister, as the Pasdar, which is the term used by religious police in Iran. And it is because they were trained by the Pasdar. So the Islamic State created these militias and then exported them. And that's true also of the support, financial and military support that Iran gave to Hezbollah in Lebanon, the only other part of the world, fortunately, where there are some Shias. We are grateful for small mercies. If there were more, I'm sure Iran would have sent more to all of us. Now, because of the characteristics that I mentioned in these periphery states, with the way capital has developed, with the way the gap between the rich and the poor is growing, in opposition, political Islam makes a lot of claims. And one of its main claims is that it's against corruption. It's the evil of the West that has corrupted our societies, is their claim. That if you listen to them, the first thing they tell people is that if it wasn't for the West, our leaders wouldn't be so corrupt. This is the message in Egypt, for example, where I understand the Muslim Brotherhood is doing very well in the fourth round of the elections. And there is truth in that, as it's truth in corruption in centers of power in any of the periphery states. The same is true of many Latin American or African countries. But that, in a way, belies the fact that the first Islamic state in the world, Iran's Islamic Republic, has really gone to levels of corruption beyond the dream of any royalist. One of the reasons why there is debate and at least dissatisfaction amongst Iranians is a referral to the sons of the clerics as the beneficiaries of these changes in Iran. And the super rich in Iran have to have some form of corruption, connection with the clerics in order to benefit from the funding that is the corrupt system of Iran's Islamic Republic. But in opposition, it is a very, if you like, a very charismatic thing to say, and it's inevitable that they do get quite a lot of support on that basis alone. Yet, even in opposition, the political Islamic movement is not in the business of accepting the reasons for corruption or for poverty. Even in opposition, despite this almost utopian ideas that suddenly you will have Sharia law and everyone will be a bit better off, at least a bit better off, there is no mechanism by which they promise such an equality. And in fact, even in opposition, they're quite clear that we are uniting as one Islamic movement, that any division into class, any division into levels of money and so on is anti-Islamic. It's not even, you know, it's really the worst enemy, because if you are talking of class divisions, you are helping the bigger enemy, which is obviously outside the borders. It's the foreign enemy, and so you shouldn't do it. And that's very powerful in the way it's used. Once the Islamic State comes to power, and here the experience of Iran is very useful, I think that we see various policies that are almost now mirrored in the Iraqi Shia state, although not quite to the same effect, because they face more of a divided society in terms of religious allegiances. And unfortunately, many of these changes will survive the current Islamic government. Even if one can envisage the overthrow of the current Islamic government in Iran, some of the changes are so dramatic that it will take a very long time to overcome these changes. One of them is a tendency towards the abolition of the modern state in its secular, in the way we understand it, i.e. in its secular format. And this is partly because although in all of our countries, and I'm talking here of Iran, even at the height of its secularism, I have to stress that Sharia law did affect judicial law and political law. It affected our constitution. It affected the Shah of times, constitution and legal structures and judicial structures. But when any form of or any superficial acceptance of secularism is taken away from that constitution, then Sharia law becomes the only law. And that has dramatic effects, not only in terms of women's rights, inheritance, the right to choose some basic freedoms, such as whether to have religion or not have religion, whether to wear what one wants or not to wear what one wants, and so on. But it also changes the way punishments are given to people, the way punishment is seen for various crimes as seen by the clerics. So you're talking of a completely different setup. And in fact, in many ways, at least in the private arena, the interference of state in the lives of people is strengthened. It's not weakened. I'm sure in Mubarak's Egypt, but also in Iran's royalist times in the 1960s and 70s, the state really didn't want to know about you unless you were active politically, and especially if you were active politically on the left. I mean, you could basically, you couldn't become rich, obviously, because that was the elite who were rich, but you could wear what you want, you could listen to what you wanted, you could drink what you want, you could eat what you want, you could be as Islamic as you wanted or as atheist as you wanted. And it isn't true that, you know, you couldn't go to pray. I mean, if you wanted to go and pray, in fact, the Shah himself claimed he was religious in many ways, so there wasn't that level. The interference of the state in the private arena becomes almost unbearable in the Islamic state once Sharia law is enforced. The problem is that after a short period, it creates its own reactions in terms of duplicity, in terms of corruption, in terms of how the better off sections of the population find ways of avoiding this adherence to strict Sharia law. And so it creates its whole categories of dual life, where I understand, at least from the middle classes upwards in Iran, people behave one way in the streets and a completely different way in their private lives, in terms of what they drink, what they listen to, what they wear, the kind of makeup they wear, and the way they behave as a group of people in their general social life. So that duplicity becomes. However, the state is quite strict. It tries to intervene, it tries to follow up what's going on, and in many ways encourages spying on individuals, encourages your neighbor to call the police, that is the morality police, but as you, some of you might have heard, is now developing very strongly in Basra, of all places, in exactly the same format that he did in Tehran. The morality police, and say, my neighbor is listening to Western music, my neighbor has just opened a bottle of wine, my neighbor is, and you can see how this can be abused apart from its whole implications in terms of interference of religion in every aspect. It also changes, obviously, issues such as education, the whole idea of how we came about. Do we accept Darwin, or do we accept the kind of things that George Bush is trying to impose in the United States, and that affects in every aspect of education. But it also changes the way, in many ways, people behave in a very hypocritical manner, because very few people who see the kind of false promises becoming exposed in a country like Iran, and that's the length of the time it's been in power, they really believe in the way that they did in 1979 or in 1980 or 1981. And as a result, a creeping and indeed a level of hypocrisy becomes so normal that the whole social fabric of society is endangered by this level of hypocrisy, where on the one hand, in the streets at least, the attempt or the pretense is that you are Islamic, but in your private life, everyone knows that very few people are adhering to any of these laws. And that level is indeed part of the problem that many see as really changing the structure of Iranian society in a way that will be very difficult to change back even when the Islamic Republic is gone. Add to that the whole idea of corruption. Even if you are arrested on an issue such as drinking alcohol and being caught drinking alcohol as opposed to drinking alcohol, or if you are caught with bits of hair showing if you are a woman, there are, depending on who arrests you, there are bribes you can pay. And so the individual and the state, even in this unbelievable level of interference of the state in private life, realizes that it's an issue of market, that you can actually pay and be sinful. And that evolves so rapidly in society, where it covers every aspect of your daily life. The most dangerous side of it is, of course, the economic side. And here, there are a number of issues. First of all, the first attempt of any Islamic state is to deprive women of work. It doesn't succeed, and it pretends at times that that isn't the aim. But at least the experience of Iran was very clear, both in the way regulation for schools were changed, regulation for dress was changed. Everything was changed with a view to encourage women to look after children. That was the principal aim of many day-to-day policies that looked like they were just minor reforms in terms of changing, for example, giving schools a 9 to 12 session and then a 3 to 6 p.m. session. So the mother had to be home between 12 and 3, and there are not many jobs you could do with that, or the enforced bail and so on. And that changes the balance. Of course, Iran also went through a war, and that affected the whole structure of economy, and the war economy was imposed, and the war economy has its own demands. But in general, the Islamic State sees the employment of labor as a rent of labor. And here, it sees it as a contract between the individual and the owner, and therefore doesn't see any need for regulatory intervention. Although it retains, and it cannot have any alternative to capitalism as the dominant mode of production, at the same time, its development as a capitalist state is severely hampered for various reasons. One of them is its adventurous foreign policy. The fact that, for example, you have, in the case of Iran, a president who every day creates an adventure everywhere he goes, but as soon as he opens his mouth, you have a foreign policy adventure happening. It does not encourage long-term investment by capitalists, by foreign capitalists. And your own capitalists have all taken the money out and very rarely invest in any structure. So even in terms of capitalist development, it faces a lot of insecurity. And although it has illusions that it can recreate pre-capitalist forms of production, that's an illusion as well. You can't go back to feudalism once you've had this, you know, capitalism developing. You can't send people back to the villages and restart agriculture and so on. And none of these states pretend it. So you've got, on the one hand, all the side effects of this uneven capitalist development that has created the shanty towns, has created the gap between the rich and the poor, and you have no economic policy to change those, except an adventurous foreign policy that stops the norms of capitalist development. Not that I'm in favor of those norms, but it really creates a chaotic economic situation. And the history of the Iranian government has been that it actually thrives in this chaotic economic situation. It goes from one crisis, economic crisis, I mean, to another. And throughout these periods, obviously, some people make astronomical amounts of money because of the way they can profit from the chaos. And yet, it does not change the balance between the rich and the poor, or it has no rules to do that. And in fact, it has no mechanism. The only way one could say that it actually, if you like, the economy is changed during the rule of the Sharia is what is called legitimate economic work and illegitimate. And there you create, first of all, a black economy, like in many other capitalist countries. But legitimate here is not just whether you're an honest broker or not, but what you produce. For example, if you're a wine shop owner, you're an illegitimate capital owner, and therefore you're banned, unless you're only selling to a very small minority of your own religion, of the Christian community. Or if you are a maker of any commodity that is seen as immoral, then you are illegal and you're not allowed. So that becomes part of the black economy, or the illegal, or the semi-legal economy. But for no other section, either in terms of tax, nor in terms of the amount of profit you can make, or the amount of exploitation you can impose on your workers, there is no restriction. And that is the essential part of the role of political Islam towards capital and relations with capital. You can have as high a profit as you want, all you are asked to do by the religious state is to adhere to the Islamic tax. In the case of Iran, one-fifth of your income, which is lower than VAT, given that then you have a corrupt state that accepts bribes, very often that means you really can make a huge sum of money without paying any tax, really, because you could make a deal with an Ayatollah in terms of building sections of his mosque or something, and by that you're paying only 10% maybe of your income, or of your profit, never mind your income. And in this way, in many ways, what remains of this state in terms of its interference is only on cultural and personal activity, not on regulating class relations. It has no, not even at the level of, I would go not just a social democratic state, but a conservative state, because even a conservative state has some rules in terms of how far it wants these kind of divisions to go in order to avoid a revolution, in order to avoid an uprising. And of course in Shia Islam we have this phenomena which our new president seems to be very keen on, which is the arrival of the 12th Shia Imam. And the 12th Shia Imam, for those of you who don't know, fell into a well at the tender age of 12, I think, maybe I'm wrong, but he was very young. And he will come back, according to Hojjatiyya, which is quite a big movement in the Shia state in Iran, not just the Shia movement, but the Shia state. He will come back where poverty has, social disorder has reached such unbelievable situation where his presence is needed. It's a bit like Messiah returning to bring, you know, peace and justice. But in order for him to come back, you have to reach this abysmal state of total destruction of everything you could ever imagine. Barbarism, I assume, is the word. And the Iranian parliament, to its credit, has debated very often the issue of whether one should let society get to that in order to facilitate or precipitate the arrival of the 12th Shia Imam, or whether one should intervene in order to reduce it. And on the current history of the Iranian state, one would say that they've definitely precipitated his arrival. I understand he made an appearance at the UN while our president was speaking, which must have been missed by the other heads of state. What I've tried to do, and I realize that I've almost come to more than the time I wanted to speak, what we are facing, therefore, is a promise that hasn't materialized, but has actually created worse situations. If you like, not only things didn't get better, but they have got a lot worse for most of the Iranian people. The levels of poverty we are seeing in Iran is such that the state itself accepts that the minimum wage it has deemed to be acceptable is below the poverty line. For many of Iran's owners of factories, the policy of non-payment of wages has become not an exception, but the norm. They actually calculate their profits on how long they can do non-payment and then pay for 2 months and not pay the rest, right? Or a few months, or a portion of it. And even the state's own, if you like, labor organizations or yellow unions accept that this has become a way of increasing profits. This in a country where privatization is unprecedented. I mean, I'm sure there is a lot of privatization going on in Turkey or in Egypt, but the kind of privatization we have seen in the last 8 years or 10 years in Iran has decimated the textile industry, for example. There is hardly a single textile factory now that hasn't been privatized. There are many reasons for this. One of them is that the state, as I said, doesn't intervene with the capitalists. But also, in any parts of a big city like Tehran, land has become extremely expensive. The most beneficial way to use this land is to build high-rises. Factory owners' main policy is not to pay wages with a view of this category of capital, is not to pay wages in order for the workers to leave so that they can then sell all the materials or give away all the machinery in the factory and then use the land to build a flat. This is in parts of, if you like, textile or industries where there isn't much profit to be made. If there is profit, such as in construction, such as in cars, manufacture where Iran is a main producer, or in the oil industry where Iran is obviously one of the second largest gas fields in the world apparently are in Iran. The petrochemical and the oil industry have all been divided up to what are called contractor firms. This is to reduce the power of the labor force to confront a major industry. So Iran's oil industry, where the oil workers fought so bravely to get rid of the Shah, is now divided into tens of contract firms. And these contract firms, because of the high levels of unemployment that goes with all this heaven on earth that political Islam has created in Iran, workers accept what are called white contracts. A white contract is when the owner gives you a sheet of paper which is white and you sign the contract. And he makes up, and this is called now, if you listen to workers from Iran, they repeatedly tell you, I've had to accept a white contract. So he sets the rules then, and then when he wants to sack them, he has no compulsion to pay anything, really. And if he doesn't pay any salaries, he can say, well, I didn't make any money and I couldn't do anything about it. And that is the other norm of this system. But in addition to this, of course, there is the whole idea that because people don't have money, all forms of illegal activity has become quite prominent in every aspect of life. One of the worst aspects is that in this moral society where Ayatollah Khomeini was so upset by seeing women's hair that we all have to cover our hair for 26 years and 9 months, prostitution is rife. And Iran is, in fact, exports prostitutes to most of the Gulf states, and this is poverty. It's for an Islamic country for this to happen, it's mainly poverty. There is no other reason for it. But also in Tehran itself, in the major cities themselves, prostitution, child labor, child prostitution are so common that the state itself, the Islamic state itself, accepts that they are the issues that it has to deal with on a regular basis, and it's so obvious that they cannot deny it. As a result of all this, I think that the way for the left to expose the dangers of political Islam, despite the differences that exist between the Sharia law in Sunni Islam and Sharia law in Shia Islam, is to point out at realities in Iran, not at political propaganda, not at what George Bush says about Iran, not at the issue of whether a nuclear plant is this or that, but look at the realities of what has happened to society, where women have no rights, where workers have no rights, where poverty has reached this level that I'm talking about, where the mentality of getting rich at all costs with using violence, any means, is the norm for the rich and the super rich. And where this populist demagogy of being anti-West is still fed, but it has almost become like Tony Blair saying, I'm in favor of democracy. I mean, people just listen to it and it's part of the background. The reality of drug addiction, the reality of exporting many of these ills into the states near us from Iran itself are the realities of political Islam in power. And unlike 26 years ago, we now have an example of political Islam in power. When this phenomenon was developing in Iran, there were a lot of illusions. There were a lot of young, even leftist Iranians who thought maybe this is the solution. Maybe if the Soviet bloc has come to some crisis, if communism hasn't brought equality in the way we hoped, if the utopia of socialism hasn't happened, maybe political Islam is an answer. Now we know, as clear as we can see it in Iran, that the result of it in power is this disaster. And I think we should use that example not only in Iran but throughout the Middle East, in Turkey, in Egypt, in every other country, to expose the dangers of political Islam, especially to the left, but more importantly, in defying its own claims of social justice, anti-corruption, and so on. Thank you very much.